All right, this is Adam Chile, PhD candidate in the Department of History, and today is November 1st, 2013, and I'm here to interview Peter Koons about his experiences with the Climate Change Institute. Okay, so just to get started, I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what attracted you to earth sciences.
It was a long time ago, and what attracted me was that I could combine what I was interested in, which was climbing mountains, with going to different parts of the earth, which then was New Zealand. So that's what that brought me into it, and then things evolved a bit, and my interest diversified, and I became more involved in earth sciences. And increasingly, I didn't lose my interest for mountains, but began to focus more and more on the interaction between mountains and atmospheric fluctuation, and that got me to where I am now.
All right. So how did that can you give me some maybe some background in terms of your education?
Yeah, I come originally from Maine, and I went to university in New Hampshire, and then after spending a few years out of university, I went to New Zealand, where I did a master's in earth sciences in the Southern Alps of New Zealand, and then went to Switzerland, where I did a PhD in Zurich on continental collision and the formation of the European Alps, and then went straight back to New Zealand onto the faculty for about 20 years before I came back to Maine, and about 10 years ago.
About 10 years ago, was it? Did you sort of shift away from mountains when you came to Maine?
No, I became. I already had a number of projects that were associated with active mountain belts. So I look at the intersection of tectonics, of action which drives the so-called solid earth, the flow in the mantle. That action and the interaction between that and the atmosphere. So I particularly look at where it's most active and the place generally where it's most active. Large active mountain belts, Southern Alps in New Zealand. I've got a number of projects in the Himalaya and Alaska, Norway. And all of those have been projects which again are ultimately looking at one aspect or the other of the coupled silicate, that is solid earth system, and atmosphere. So it didn't, things shifted a bit when I came to New Zealand, but excuse me, to Maine from New Zealand, but my interest in genesis of mountains didn't really. At that point, I had more funding from the US to work on Alaskan mountains, particularly, and also some Himalayan work.
Yeah. So you had been at New Zealand for quite a long time. Why come to Maine?
Well, again, I grew up here, so that had some attraction. So there were personal reasons, but the larger reason was that I had an interest in the integration or answering some questions which were possible in the structure that was here at the University of Maine, including the Climate Change Institute. That is, I was interested in not just the very long wavelength variations that occur when one continent runs into the other, but I was interested in the interaction at a much higher frequency, spatial frequency, that is, shorter, steeper things, and also temporal frequency associated with things like earthquakes and climate changes and the influence back and forth between those. And the opportunity to do that in Maine was significant, and I was also increasingly interested in, as part of that, look at higher frequency variation. At forecasting for future changes as well. So that made good sense from the position of the University of Maine.
So you came in what, 2000?
2002.
2002.
Yeah.
So somebody from the Climate Change Institute contacted you, said.
I started fully in the Department of Earth Sciences. Then when I was here, I was offered a position sharing in CCI and earth sciences, and that was probably after I'd been here for a year or so. I'm not sure exactly, but on that order. And so I'm 30%, officially 30%, I think, in CCI and the remainder in this department.
Mm-hmm. I see. How do you see your research fitting in with what other scholars in CCI are doing?
I've told you sort of what my interests are, but my tools that I use are mostly solutions of numerical equations, families of numerical equations, which describe these processes. So there may be one set of processes is flow in the mantle, which is a very viscous fluid. And so I model that numerically, but I also model the interaction between that flow and the atmosphere, which, again, I have numerical models for. So my contribution mostly here is to work with modeling of various systems, and particularly coupled systems. And therefore, I can interact with people who work at level of glacial fluctuations, and I have several funded glacial projects, or I can work with people who deal more with the longer-term geology, people like George Denton and Brenda Hall and so on, who deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, I've become involved with the other aspects that are associated with modeling systems, such as with bird migration and other things, which it's relatively straightforward for me to work with those people who know something actually about it, whereas I know something about the fluid behavior, fluid dynamics. They know something about the phenomena themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy for me to work across those boundaries, and that's one of the things I really enjoy about it.
Mm-hmm. In speaking with members of the Institute, one of the things just about everyone has stressed is the interdisciplinary character of the Institute. Have you worked with members of CCI that are maybe in a different field?
Well, I mentioned the bird migration, which is sort of a different field, but that's it makes good sense when you, in a way, and that birds fly through this the fluid atmosphere, and I can model the fluid atmosphere, so that makes some sense. I've worked with people. That's sort of Brian Olson and the students there. Gordon Hamilton and the students on glacial flow, as I mentioned, George, and other people. So it's easy for me. My discipline bridges many of those, so it's easy actually to at least contribute something to them and to work with them. Yeah, so that's one of the things that attracts me about it. I have associations with some other institutions, and they're very, very good institutions, University of Washington or the University of Colorado. They have good, very famous climate groups, but they don't quite have this cross-disciplinary view of it. Maybe it's because they're so large. They're very active, very good, but that's one of the attractive bits about this, is that I can see Dan Sandweiss, for instance, on a regular basis, or I can deal with glacial people or biological people.
Mm-hmm. Had you heard of the Institute when it was the Quaternary Institute? And so you would have been still in New Zealand then.
Yeah, they've had a very long, you've probably seen this, very long association with Antarctic research, and almost all Antarctic research from the U.S. Used entirely go through New Zealand, and so I was regularly seeing people from the University of Maine. Always was a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Going through the New Zealand Antarctic program. And it's not necessary that all do. There's other parts of the Antarctic that they get to from other directions, but mostly they do. So I was aware of the contributions, and certainly of the contributions of people like George Denton and others who had a long association in New Zealand and also in the Antarctic.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sort of part of the founders of this, too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
What would you say was the most difficult place you ever worked?
The difficulty is a cultural difficulty, and that is Northwest Pakistan and the Pakistan Kashmir against the Afghan border, and that's mostly because people were shooting everybody right, left, and center. And it's the mountains have a serious. There's a serious difficulty associated with working in the mountains, but it pales compared to dealing with the the local tribes and the tribal differences. And so that would be the most difficult.
Can you think of a specific instance or anecdote that comes to mind?
There were plenty, but they were mostly associated with arguments which, well, we were in Gilgit at the end of a field season. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but Gilgit is at the edge of the Indus River and is sort of the center of really Pakistan, Taliban now. But at that point, the Taliban was more of an ally to the West than an enemy, so it wasn't quite the same. But anyway, there was a riot in the town. They instituted martial law, and we were stuck in it for about 7 days. And then in getting out, there were lots of heavy machine gun operations, sometimes firing, sometimes just covering. It wasn't any fun. There are other things, other places to work. So my colleagues and I moved our research program to the other side of the Himalaya, which was where the Tsangpo runs through the Himalaya on the eastern side, and looked at similar interactions between climate and the earth at the other end of the mountain range.
Mm.
So,
Had you ever worked in Antarctica?
I haven't. No, I've avoided it, but not necessarily intentionally, except that I didn't, particularly from New Zealand. There was a large time commitment in the New Zealand winter, say August, about a 3-week commitment prior to going down on the ice for preparation, and I decided I would do other things.
Mm.
And when I, the U.S. commitment isn't really quite as long, surprisingly. So I may still go, but I won't go this year anyway.
Mm. So you said that your work contributes to, say, the work of George Denton and Brenda Hall. Did you publish any papers with them?
I haven't, no, and I may or may not. When I say my work contributes to it, the things that I do, that is the tools that I use for determining, let's say, glacial rebound and those kinds of things, is associated with unloading, are relevant to what they do. And we have, Brenda and I have submitted proposals to the National Science Foundation. They've been unsuccessful, but we've done that together. So that's where I've contributed
mm-hmm.
primarily.
Mm-hmm. What do you think has been the Institute's most important contributions to our understanding of climate?
Well, there'd be several, and they belong to different people, but certainly Paul Majewski's involvement before he came here, but with the abrupt climate change, and since he's come here too, he's certainly pursued things in many ways, but that was the first recognition of the rapid changes that global circulation patterns would go through from his Greenland work. That would be a huge contribution. The contributions I think that George Denton has made through the time and recently, working out why these big fluctuations that led to ice ages, I think that's a major change in the understanding of the way the Earth works that wouldn't have existed without somebody like George driving it. He, as he points out, he's worked with many people. It isn't by any means just George, but nevertheless, he's driven that program for the last 30 years, pretty much. And so I'd say that's a major change. And there are a bunch of others which are important, but they don't necessarily show up quite as distinctly as those two.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I see. You know, it seems to me that in the scientific community, there's no debate about climate change and the human role in it. But in American political culture, it is still up for debate.
Mm.
I'm wondering if you can comment as to why that might be the case.
Oh, it's a... I can't comment, but it's... So I think there's several things which are inherent to individuals that we tend to think whatever, wherever we live, however the conditions are steady. And I don't know why one thinks that, but we tend to think that this is sort of steady state. It may be that fluctuations don't usually occur within our lifetime. We're usually wrong about that, of course. But I think there's a tendency to think that, it's November, it should be ice forming in Maine or something like that, and that's the way it's always been. Until we start looking at the record and we say, of course, it hasn't always been like that. So I think there's something inherent in humans that doesn't think in a transient way easily. But that doesn't really excuse it. I think that the real reason is because there's been a concerted, financially a huge effort to obscure the processes, the facts, and the communication by scientists. And it's characterized, or it's described pretty well in several reputable publications. Merchants of Doubt captures much of this. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's Naomi Orestes and another co-author have pointed out that the hydrocarbon industry employs methods that were used previously for looking at or for holding up tobacco legislation often by the same people, the same groups, in fact, all the way through, and they're now employing the same methods, which are to seed some sort of doubt about whatever the science is. Well, all science is uncertain, so it's an easy thing to do, and particularly if you're clever about it, one can sort of destroy the confidence that society has in the findings. And scientists are only recently coming to grips with how to deal with uncertainty and getting uncertainty across to the population. And we don't necessarily deal with it well. So I think that's been taken advantage of by groups who would rather not see climate change be recognized. So it's been taken advantage of in a very clear, concise way, very cynical, but nevertheless efficient.
What role should the Climate Change Institute play in informing public opinion?
I guess that it would be a role which is similar to society's or science's responsibility to society anyway. I think CCI comes within that, underneath that broader umbrella, and that is that we have a role to provide truth as we know it at the time to society, and not just to sit on it, and not perhaps to, and whether we choose to go down a route by which we spend all of our time promulgating this this truth or not is another fact, but actually absolutely not communicating it is a mistake, and I think we have a responsibility to continue to search for the truth as it appears, and secondly, to communicate it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's certainly the broader science responsibility to society, and I think CCIs is within that very much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things the Institute has done?
I think there are probably many things that I don't know of that it's done, but I think from a scientific perspective, some of the things that I was talking to before are important. Certainly the ice core work, which is a big chunk of the Institute, records changes in atmospheric chemistry which are absolutely critical to understanding the way global circulation patterns are affected and the chemistry of the atmosphere is affected. Getting that information out is really critical piece of what the university does and what CCI does and therefore the university. Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of other things too which are important, but I guess the stability and reliability of the information that comes out of CCI for global records of atmospheric circulation are hugely important. Yeah. So they are many of these records and these data points are So they're critical to understanding the way systems work, and they lend themselves to building up a framework which we can understand the way the systems are changing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very valuable.
Mm-hmm. So if we were able to convince everybody that we need to reduce carbon emissions, what would we do then?
In terms of what would we do to actually cause the carbon to be reduced, or what would we do to, in terms of observing the Earth, how can
yeah,
you elaborate
well,
on that?
Yeah, what would we need to do to really address the problem effectively?
The as you're probably aware, the economies are currently set up so they don't really favor the reduction in carbon production. And so in order to make a significant difference, one would have to, if you've convinced people, great, then it wouldn't be difficult, but one still has to make the changes in the way our economy partitions funding into one system versus another. And there are an awful lot of toes to be stepped on there. I mean, we are dealing with systems which, changes which would require petrochemical changes or hydrocarbon changes, which is the largest industry the Earth has probably ever seen in terms of finances. And to make changes to that industry would be very serious. So it's a matter of convincing people that it has to be done and then actually doing it. It will come down to economics. I don't know. We have communications through CCI with our with U.S. congressional representatives, and they're not trivial. And it turns out, much to my surprise, that Maine has a remarkable amount of influence on our congressional people, who have a lot of influence in the U.S. Senate and, to a lesser extent, the House. But it's such a dysfunctional body right now that it's hard to say whether that actually would work. However, people like Collins and so on do have some influence. And so it may be that that probably is the only way that changes will come about, is through people like Susan Collins and Ben Gree and so on, making maintaining influence at the national level. But the alternative to saying that they have some influence is to say there is no future for the climate as we see it now.
Sure.
The grassroots exercises, which are things like 350, Project 350, whatever its specific name is called, are probably very, very useful, and probably a requirement to make the general public aware of the need for some sort of change. Any individual one of those programs probably will be insufficient, but maybe taken as a whole, they'll make a difference. Don't know.
How do you think the Institute has changed since its founding?
It was founded by, you have met some of the people, it was founded by people who were mostly interested in very long-term climate change and quaternary, the long period compared to much of the research now. I think we're focusing increasingly on a shorter term variation. There still is the deep time component, but much more we're focusing on the shorter term and the implications of that shorter term to society. And that it's far bigger than it was, and that does mean that there's more diversity and perhaps more scattering of energy too because of that.
And so that, I guess, leads me to another question, and that is that the membership in the Institute has grown quite a bit. Has that created difficulties in remaining cohesive?
I'm not sure it's difficulties. I've been on the, and chaired the peer committee. There are a number of, the membership has grown, but of course the status or the levels of the way people are associated with it is such that some of the people are directly associated with it. Some are members of the salaried members, and that's still relatively small. So there, some of us are, as I say, have our salary both in CCI and Earth Sciences or one of the other ones. But the other associations with other individuals, I think, has increased the richness of CCI. It's increased its ability to to deal with broader issues, I don't see any particular detriment to CCI at all of the increased membership, but I do see that there, in the future, there could be some sort of splintering, but I certainly don't. I mean, there are a lot of things that could be a problem in the future, and there's not necessarily, that isn't necessarily the largest one, I think. So I welcome the breadth of CCI. I think that there's some directions where we could have increased breadth and still be a much stronger institution.
I see. Shifting back to your own work, so you worked in Pakistan and you've worked in New Zealand. What are some other regions in which you've worked?
Worked in Switzerland, Norway, Alaska. I've got proposals in for the accepted for the Antarctica and the other end of the Himalaya that I mentioned, Tibet area particularly, and Tibet and China. And then I've got some of the programs that I'm working and funded are looking at modeling of global circulation systems, and I do that from here, but they're associated with global systems, and that's probably more of what I'm, the direction I'm going in now.
I see. What was the longest you were ever out doing field research in one go?
Probably 3 months at a time. That would be in New Zealand. Yeah, I've been out in the Himalaya for 2 months at a time.
And were there, you had mentioned, of course, there can, you encountered some political challenges. What about the physical components?
Well, the I'm actually getting a funded project in New Zealand now, and I was just talking to one of my grad students who's going over the first time, which is why this map happens to be here. And the physical components of this, particularly when I originally was working there, are really significant because of the very thick bush and the very steep in places, even though the total elevation is relatively minor. Whereas the Himalaya, the big changes, the big challenges outside of the the societal ones are elevation is a serious problem, because most of the work that I was doing was associated with elevations above, say, 5,000 meters and stuff. So there.
So you worked pretty high.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any close calls?
I had mountaineering calls, but I didn't have any kind of any altitude-related problems particularly, although people of our of groups sometimes did, but I didn't have altitude at close calls. But we typically, if you work in the high mountains, you will have blocks come down where you wish they hadn't. Yeah.
Okay, so a few moments that might have taken your breath away.
Actually, the picture on the lower left there is, that's the north face of Nanga Parbat, and it's a huge face. I think it's the largest face on Earth. And the in the middle of that, it looks like it's the middle of the face, but it's definitely the lower part, is actually represented. We're a little closer up on the right-hand lower one. Anyway, the first time I went there with another colleague from New Zealand, and we spent a lot of time in a lot of mountains, different parts of the world, we thought, well, we'll go up there. It looks a particularly safe spot from the avalanches and so on, and we can bivvy here and move on to the face and such and such. Anyway, it turned out that the place that we thought was so safe, it's the one on the right, had was a spot where I think 32 of the 32 German alpinists just prior to the Second World War were killed by a massive avalanche that came off the top. And the these ice falls and Serac collapses are huge compared to anything that we had ever seen outside of the Himalaya. And they covered an area which was so much vastly, so huge compared to what we considered, that we considered ourselves safe, but you know, this, we were just lucky, absolutely lucky. So there were a number of those things happen.
What kinds of equipment did you take with you?
Well, for those, that's just mountaineering equipment. I mean, take some ropes and crampons and axes and so on.
No particular instruments?
Yeah, and for what we were doing there, There were two things. We were observing the rock types, but also, since I am, again, mostly a modeler, I go along mostly because I like to be there. And so we were measuring in places things like the size of the moraine, how old the moraine might be. We were picking up rocks from different elevations. For a specific reason there, though, which is because those rocks have gone up faster than any other rocks on Earth. And as they go up, they hold the signal from, in this case, about 30 kilometers deep. So they've gone up something like here on the order of 40 kilometers because they're about 6 kilometers above the surface there. So they've gone up, and as they go up, they carry with them the heat and the signal of that rapid movement. And so we were looking for those particular signals.
I see.
Mm. So the high mountains are also associated with, they're there because the materials come up quickly, which makes sense, but that also brings with it a deep-seated a geological signal, which we were looking for.
Mm. And I take it you had to camp out there.
We did, yeah.
And you took all the food.
Yeah, so this is the picture on the left is taken at the base camp on the for that north face, Ryko face. And we had help and carried gear into there. And then the two of us would go up to various individual parts of it. And there was part of a larger group that was doing work on other aspects of the same massif.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's pretty typical of work that I've done in the other parts of the Himalaya and Alaska. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's all the questions I have. But before we conclude the interview, I did want to give you a chance to maybe add something that I didn't ask you about.
I can't think of anything.
Okay.
Yep.
Great.